What's your favorite board game?
So in high school, it would have been Diplomacy. Today, it's probably either Twilight Imperium or Gloomhaven.
Nerd.
Yeah.
Nerd say what?
What?
Welcome to Subscurity, the podcast about obscure subcultures. I'm Brenna.
And I'm Jordan. And today we're talking about Dip Conners. What is your favorite board game?
Ooh, that's a good question.
Oh, I know. I knew you would like this question. I think you're going to like this topic. But sorry, what's your favorite board game?
Okay, so I feel like I have to preface this for our listeners. The game is not what it sounds like.
I know what you're going to say now.
Secret Hitler. Yeah. It's like mafia in a board game. Basically, it's fascists versus liberals, but it's all, your role is kept a secret. So you're kind of, it's a secret cooperative game, basically, to win as a collective unit. And I like it because it's deceptive. You get to like pretend. There's accusations. I don't know. I love it. It's a lot of fun.
Do you like playing as, well, so I guess I think for context, right? Like the, like you said, it's like mafia, but the point is that for most of the game, no matter what team you're on, you're playing as if you're a good guy, right?
Yes. You want to appear as if you're a good guy. The trick is, and there are fewer bad guys, fewer fascists than there are liberals in the game. However, there are more fascist cards than liberal cards. So it obviously lends itself to a lot of lies, a lot of deception, and a lot of confusion.
Right. So everyone's kind of pointing fingers saying, you're a fascist, you're a fascist. And the fascist job is just basically to...
No, I'm a liberal. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Get a and liberal killed.
And to give cover for their Hitler, but the person that's in charge of theirs and until that team can secretly come to a victory, right?
Correct. Trust me, it's a really fun, family-friendly game.
But I think... Well, so the reason I'm asking and the reason I kind of expect that answer and the reason I wanted to talk about it is because for you, it sounds like the enjoyment of the game comes from the deceptive nature and kind of the ability to be a little sneaky, a little backstabby. And then ultimately, I mean, ideally if it playing, assuming you're playing on the quote unquote bad guys team, but if you're on the good guys team, even then you're kind of trying to root out who's being honest, who's not being honest and so forth. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've established on the show that I should be a secret spy. That is like my favorite thing. So yeah, I like the hijinks of it. I like when I'm the bad guy tricking people and that's really fun. But yeah, when I'm the good guy, I like to put my detective skills to work.
Yeah. So it's the social engineering aspect of it that kind of appeals to you. It's like some people like board games because they are, there's like a lot of strategy in terms of like playing the game, right? Or, you know, if you think even something as simple as the old classics of like Monopoly or Scrabble, mm-hmm. or something like that, right? It's the fun comes from what's on the board. But in a game like this, the fun comes from your interactions with other people, right?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it.
Thank you.
It's like you're inside my brain.
Yeah, you're a fascist, by the way. So have you heard of the game Diplomacy?
I've heard of it.
Okay. So Diplomacy is more commonly known as the game that ruins friendships.
Oh.
So I think you're going to love it. But
are we playing today? Because this sounds fun.
We don't have time, and I'll explain why. So Diplomacy is a game where you are essentially controlling armies on a big map, right? So the most common like example I think people think of today is Risk, the idea of having a giant map, you have armies, and your job is to conquer the map, right? And that's how you win. Diplomacy is a little different, though, than these other games, because the only way you can accomplish victory is by building alliances and eventually reneging on those alliances.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Kind of like Settlers of Catan in a way.
Kind of like Survivor, the TV show, which I think you also are a big fan of.
My favorite TV show. And if I ever go on a surprise, like 3-month hiatus where I can't say where I am, it's because I'm filming and in the process of winning Survivor.
Brenna's sick again, so I'll be doing this podcast by myself again.
Those poor people.
Yeah, so Diplomacy, it's a board game that was created in 1959 or created and released in 1954, 1959. Like I said, it's a conquering game. So it's a map. The game board is a map of Europe, started in 1901. And all the teams, so 2 to 8 players can play this game. And each person controls one of the major powers, kind of that was preluding to World War One, right? So you have, England and France and Austria-Hungary and so forth. And like I was saying, the only way for you to kind of move and control things is to have more than one person on your team. In a game like Risk or in a lot of other kind of those war games, you can just build lots of more armies and you throw them at a part of the map that you want to take over, and that's how you win.
Like an alliance. You need help from someone else, exactly, who you're inevitably going to stab in the back.
Exactly, because in this game, one arm, every like spot on the map, every territory on the map can only have one army, and one army going against one army is always a draw.
Okay.
There's no inherent advantage. So you need two armies to go into one spot, which means you need one army to say, I'm going in, and another army to support. And you only have limited armies of your own. So you need to build alliances with other players to say, hey, I'm going to go invade this part of France. Can you lend support from your army that's in the next territory so that I can conquer that piece of land from this player?
So you need two armies to conquer France. I'm surprised it's not just like a white flag.
We got them, says the French girl.
What's the subculture we're exploring, Jordan? Are we just talking about a board game? Because that's not a subculture.
It's the competitive diplomacy players.
Wait, like they play professionally
A world championship of diplomacy that takes place every year in a tournament. So, and the reason this topic has been like front of mind for me for like the last couple of weeks is because you had the puzzle topic, and it kind of triggered that same idea.
Is this what you asked me about? If we were allowed to record so closely to the puzzle,
I couldn't resist this. Like it's been occupying way too much of my mind space.
Just like I'm going to occupy whatever countries you're in the game of diplomacy when I win.
So the other reason we can't play tonight, besides the fact there's only two of us, and that's kind of defeats the purpose of building alliances. I wonder if you'll be betraying me. Is diplomacy takes a very long time to play.
Like how long are we talking?
Like minimum 8 hours.
What the fuck?
So unlike other games, turns are not played asynchronously, as in people don't go in order, right? Okay. So it's not like my turn, then your turn, then player three's turn.
Thank you for defining that.
Instead, everyone plays their turn at the exact same time. So the bulk of the game, a lot like Secret Hitler, the bulk of the game is not actually what is happening on the board. What actually ends up happening is you spend half an hour, sometimes multiple hours, talking to people.
Convincing them to invade the same space as you or not to invade the space you want to go to.
Exactly. When I played this, most of the game is you saying, hey, Joe, can I go in this room with you? We need to talk about what we're going to do.
People will leave the room and not even discuss strategy in front of the rest of the group?
Yeah, it's completely secret. And then you go and do that with six other people. And so everyone has all these conversations with each other continuously until someone finally says, hey, we have to play this turn, or there was a built-in timer that people have agreed to use or whatever else.
Everyone, it is like Survivor.
Exactly. Everyone writes their orders in on a piece of paper.
Oh, I'm going to vote you out.
you put it in a pot, and you reveal all the orders at the same time, and everything happens at the same time. And so that will tell you, did Joe agree to do what we said we were going to do? Or did Joe then turn around knowing that I was going to move into that spot and backstab me and take my territory from me?
Wow.
Tell me this doesn't appeal to you.
It appeals to me. I'm surprised I've never played it. So have you won this game? How frequently have you played it?
Oh, I've never finished a game. Like I played this probably at least half a dozen times in high school and later, and no game has ever ended. Yes.
Oh my God.
Loser. Yes. But also it was really fun until everyone got mad at each other. And then you walk away just bitter and angry and feeling like you wasted 6 hours, and maybe you're not going to talk to your friends for the next couple months.
So just kind of a sidebar. Do you think that would go differently now in adulthood, or like, do you feel,
I think it really depends on who you're playing with.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think for me, like I never had that big of an issue, frankly, because we've talked about this before. I don't find myself super competitive. Like I enjoy it. It's a game, but like I'm going to try to win, but I don't care if I lose. I recognize eventually someone's going to backstab me. But other people, it's very personal. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, especially for the people who play this. The word's not professionally, but play competitively at, you know, world tournament level.
Yeah. And when they're at the world tournament level, like, do you get to bring teams or is it all just individual players who've never met before and you're really trying to win over brand new competitors?
Kind of yes, no. So it's not teams, right? It's every, you're always out for yourself.
Right.
However, the best players tend to congregate at the tournament. So you get, you know who you're playing. You know, it's kind of like
the same. Are you telling me this isn't like a widespread group of people? You start to see familiar faces in the crowd.
I think, yeah, that's part of it. And also at like the really good players do end up filtering to the top of tournaments. Right. So it's kind of, you know, it's like tennis in a way. Like you might have a lot of people who are competing at Wimbledon, but a lot of times the kind of the top of the tournament is going to be the same faces and you kind of know who you're going to be playing. You know, Venus or Serena is going to be there, right?
Yeah.
Even if like you didn't have to face them until the very end or something. So we'll talk about the people specifically, but you know, diplomacy itself is, it's one of those like famous, but not famous games. It's famous within like board gaming culture. Again, okay. as a game that ruins friendships, since it was created back in the 50s, there's a lot of famous people who have been known to be huge fans of it. John F. Kennedy in particular, it was considered his favorite board game and was played in the White House.
Interesting.
Henry Kissinger as well. Walter Cronkite, the most trusted man in America. Right? they all loved it. And people who do endorse it often kind of think of it as a learning tool of realpolitik, as in this teaches you how much the way nation states like interact with each other is based on a very fragile system of trust, right? Yeah. Where everyone knows they're out for themselves, even if they need other people to succeed, right? So there is a school of, there's an actual school like foreign policy that this game subscribes to. And a lot of like Henry Kissinger, for example, there's a reason why he likes the game because it matches kind of, or he's alive. It matches his style of his interpretation of how foreign policy should work on the international level.
Gotcha.
To expand on that, a famous board game designer named Larry Harris, who designed the board game Axis and Allies, which is another one of these kind of war games based on historical war themes. He's actually known for saying, I'm going to just quote him directly, "I'm convinced that Alan Kallhammer's masterpiece, the game Diplomacy, should be part of every high school curriculum. Don't tell kids, but it teaches history, geography, the art of political negotiation, and something else, some healthy critical skepticism. By the time you get into high school, you have a pretty good idea that not everyone always tells the truth. But a good game of diplomacy helps you understand how skillful some people can be at fooling you."
I honestly like that without ever having played it. I mean, there's so much to criticize about modern day schooling in the U.S. and, you know, how unengaging it is and how far behind we are, especially in like math and science and I think even geography. But
Definitely geography.
But something like that, I think, yeah, it kind of hits on all those things he said. I'm sure there's a way to condense it or you do it over multiple days, whatever. But I think that would be like probably the most fun way to learn about politics, negotiation, geography, and you get some social learning along with it.
And that's where I first discovered the game because a high school, I can't remember if it's humanities or some sort of history class teacher, but he introduced diplomacy to the class as a way to kind of supplement lessons on World War One, and had us playing the way you described it, right? Like multiple days of sessions.
So you would really play it.
We played it in class, not like nonstop, but over multiple days. And to that point, diplomacy was one of, if not the first game to popularize the idea of playing by mail. So people, because it was often hard.
Playing by mail, what do you mean?
Playing by post. Like, because it was often hard to get a group of people, one, to play a board game, two, to play a board game the last 8 hours, three, to play a board game that you're going to end your friendship over potentially, people would often find ways of connecting people across the country, like the United States. And they would all send letters to each other. This is, you know, in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And so, and the games could last months, years, because, and every turn would take place over like 2 weeks or something. And so you would be writing to each other, telling you what your plans were. And then you would all finally mail your final orders in, and then it would reveal, and then the next turn would happen. Right. And so it popularized this way of playing, which to now we would just use the internet, right?
Right.
But it kind of predated that by giving people a way to play this game without having to actually be in person and sit through it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, but the, you know, today the top tournaments are played in person. And the top tournament is known as World Diplomacy Convention, also known as World DIPCON.
DIPCON.
Yep. It is played in many different places around the world. The winner is considered to be the world champion of diplomacy for that year. It was first held in 1988 in Birmingham, England, and then was held in 2 year intervals before some time, I don't know exactly when, becoming an annual event. The last one was actually played in 2019, thanks COVID. But otherwise it has been played every single year, and it rotates in, it rotates the site where it's being hosted among North America, Europe, Australasia, and then the rest of the world.
Do every year, do the hosts of the tournament go to separate rooms and decide where the tournament's going to be played? That's a diplomacy joke about diplomacy.
Yeah, that's good. I don't know. I don't know how they decide that. But they do have some fun things. Like there is a Golden Blade Award, which is an award they give to the player who has the best stab, aka backstab, of the entire tournament. So even if you're not the winner, you can still receive accolades for completely ruining someone else's day. I'm going to give you a quote. This is from a Grantland article. Grantland, unfortunately, no longer exists as a website, but there was an article an author wrote there where when he attended a diplomacy convention, and he was participating, and this was, I guess it was kind of his first time playing. And so he was somewhat being quarterbacked by other players, right? There was a lot of pushing on his naivety and kind of trying to control his strategy to benefit themselves.
Right.
So I'm just going to kind of read you how he wrote some of his experience here. It was the summer of 1909. I was on the south coast of Spain. I remember it well because the season was almost over. Peace was within reach, I felt. There had been a vote to end the war, and the English had told me to support it. But the vote needed to be unanimous to pass, and it failed. The Russian, the Italian, they thought the English voted against it, and that I had been lied to. Why should I believe them? The English and I had worked together against all of them for years now. Of course they'd want to sow distrust between us. Time was ticking. I desperately wanted peace. I wasn't sure my country would survive another couple years, with or without England's help. "Will you support my army in Spain this fall?" I asked. "Nah, that ain't happening," the Englishman replied. A wave of dread came over me. He was going to betray me. "How could you do this to me? Ever tear everything I've done for you? I guess I'm just a hard motherfucker like that." And with that, he walked away, leaving me standing in the hallway, mouth agape. He rejoined the other players of the board, who stared at me, fury in their eyes. "We told you so."
It really does remind me of Survivor, right? And I'm just going to go on a tiny little tangent slash plug, just because, you know, our episodes come out on Wednesday. Survivor also airs on Wednesday at 8
Eastern. Not sponsored.
8 Eastern, 7 Central. But it reminds me so much, because there's a season happening right now, which was long awaited because, I mean,
COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they have been on for 41 seasons, so 20 years, and 2020, yeah, was the first year they couldn't film. So It was a year and a half, 2 years, whatever it was, without Survivor, which was, you know, this big abrupt change in my life, because I've literally always watched Survivor. It's the only show I've ever, you know, watched live or like current, you know what I mean, throughout.
And long enough to have someone be able to have reached drinking age.
Yes. Yes. But yeah, it's so fun. But anyway, like, it's just reminding me of some of those conversations. That's why I love watching it, is because you just see the social dynamics play out. You wonder, could I read a person? I think I'd be able to read a person if they're lying to me. But then you see people get shocked, and they call it blindsided when they don't know they're going to be voted out. And even when people sow the distrust, and I could tell you, oh, so-and-so is going to vote for you, and I could be telling the truth and you might not believe me. And so that's exactly what that scenario is kind of laying out. And it's that same kind of just social dynamic that I just love watching.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I enjoy it too, right? I watched a lot of the early Survivor. I haven't kept up with it, but I enjoy that concept. And that's why I've always liked Diplomacy, because it's watching people, I don't know if the right word is exploit, but like test the limits of human nature and human trust.
Yeah.
Right. And what we can get away with in polite society, but within a controlled and safe setting, or at least should be considered a safe setting. Right.
And is that the appeal for you? Like how much you can get away with? Cause for me, I
think it's an appeal to watch what people can get away with. Like, I don't care for myself, but like, it's interesting seeing people's personalities change at the table, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I always think it's interesting too, like more watching on the receiving end is just people who can pick up on lies. Like there's one player, she's played a couple seasons and she is just, I know so-and-so is lying to me. And she just has like a really good gut instinct and she navigates the game really well. So I always like seeing that end of it too. If someone calls the other person on their bullshit or they go along with it and they say to the camera in a confessional, I know Jordan's lying to me. I can't believe he thinks I'm stupid enough to go for that. That's all also fascinating to me too. And man, I could just have my own Survivor podcast, but it's similar. Like people take it really seriously, even though you're signing up for a game for $1 million where ever since like season one, people have been lying to and backstabbing each other. People still take it really personally. Not everyone, but some people have a really hard time, I think, getting overvoted out and being lied to.
Yeah. There's a quote in a different article that, talked about just kind of witnessing the tournament level play, witnessing players interact. And basically they clearly somebody, did not agree to something. Mm-hmm. And the author just hears this person yell, "You want some, you don't know me. Bring it, bring it." As he stormed out of the room, Buffalo shouted, "I'll play all night. I don't give a fuck." And he goes on to say basically that often the anger players would get so angry because other players wouldn't cooperate with them that they would take to shouting, browbeating, cursing, making insults.
Which like, never works, by the way.
No, but it's like the expression of that frustration, that moment, right? Yeah, and then I enjoy witnessing that. Like,
yeah.
Because again, for me, I don't take it as seriously, right? Now, I might, if I'd flown thousands of miles, taking a couple of days off work to compete in this tournament and get fucked like right at the end of an intense round, like I get that frustration, but like, would I be screaming at somebody? I don't think so.
Well, it does remind me of Secret Hitler, because when I am a liberal, I think I fairly frequently can identify who the fascists are.
Yeah.
And I think of all the times where at least I have, I'm like, oh, it's Jordan and you just convince everyone else. And we're like, no, it's Brenna. And I get furious and people are like, look, it's definitely you. You're so mad. I'm like, no, I'm mad because I'm telling the truth.
Right.
And
it amplifies.
I'm just like, why don't you believe me? Why are you so stupid? Why don't you see that Jordan is the fascist? So did the
okay,
people,
I do like doing that. I do like that manipulation part of the game too. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the competitive events, is it a different caliber of players? Like, do they still get like really upset, or would you say there's a more kind of understanding because they play in tournaments that they know it's a game? So do you see less emotion or not really?
Well,
sure?
a lot of the quotes are from tournaments. So you do see people get very upset. There is conversely, some of the top level players they're more careful on terms of how they approach the game and how they backstab and how they break alliances, right? Because they know
it's fragile.
When they know that these games do not happen in isolation,
mm-hmm.
right? Like especially with the players who are there frequently, the players who are frequently rise at the top. If you have a reputation for not being trustworthy, that's bad for you when you need to get an alliance to actually work out for you, right?
Yeah, for something like that, it's not, you'd be naive to think like it's one game in a vacuum and that your actions in one game won't carry your reputation into another game and so on and so forth.
Yeah, so to that point, Andrew Goff, who is currently known as the best player in the world. Yes, this like they rank players.
Andrew Goff.
Andrew Goff, he's from the United States. Oh, I hope he is. I believe he is. But he placed first in the 2018 tournament and second in the 2019 tournament. So pretty respectable.
So we don't think the person who got number one in 2019 is the best player in the world. We think the guy who got first, then second.
I mean, you can argue that, you know, currently, maybe it's I don't know what the person was that got first in 2019. But the point is, like, to go back-to-back top two, right? Like, this guy's pretty good. He is known for not being, very deceptive as a player. He was quoted as saying, "Well, there have been a few deceptive omissions on my part, but no, I didn't tell a single outright lie the entire tournament," in the tournament that he actually won. He specifically, chooses not to take a ruthless or malicious approach when he plays. And he says he treats the relationships that he has with other players like he's campaigning to be a politician. And again, politicians love this game, or have known to be love this game, because from his perspective, being well-intentioned, or at least appearing to be well-intentioned, to build that diplomatic capital, he can actually leverage that further in the game and in other games, rather than trying to twist arms and then, you know, backstab somebody.
Oh, totally. Because I think if you can lie to someone or betray them in a way that you still come off as, oh, I didn't mean to, or I had no other option, as long as you don't come off with this perception that you were doing it kind of maliciously or aggressively, I mean, your perception is just going to be better, and that's going to carry more weight for you at the end.
Right. He says that diplomacy to him is ultimately about building trust in an environment that it encourages you not to trust anyone. And this is a guy who's been playing diplomacy since he was 14 years old.
He knows what he's talking about.
He knows what he's talking about. I should say, though, he has become a ruthless liar when it has been an irresistible advantage to a positive outcome for him. You know, he even admits, "I'm no paragon of moral perfection." His top two world champion rival, Doug Moore, which maybe he's the person who won 2019. I'll need to check that. But describes Goff as saying he doesn't yell. He almost never has to lie. He rarely has to threaten. He listens. It's a superpower. But then in a specific tournament, he did go ahead and backstab to help win a game, right? Like, yeah. If you need to take that win, you need to take that win, is from his perspective. So the players that participate in, you know, kind of the top level play, you've got players like that who come with kind of a more diplomatic approach. You have players who are more willing to backstab. You also have players who are called care bearers. So one interesting kind of facet of the game, which I don't know if it's in the original rules or if it's just what happens in tournaments, but games can end in mutually agreed draws. So think of it like an actual war, like World War, where people just decide to end the game, right? Like to end the war.
End the
game of war, because war is a game. But as in, once enough players have been eliminated, if, let's say, the Russian and English players are still alive, they might say, "Look, we're going to agree. We're going to call this a draw, and the game's going to end here, and we mutually carry this win out." And that's allowed to happen, but of course any prize money gets split then, right? So it's a distinct choice that you're making to kind of limit your potential total winning, right?
Yeah. So do you know how many people enter the tournament every year? I'd also like to know the demographics, because I'm guessing there's not a lot of women nor a lot of people of color, if I were to go out on a limb.
Your limb is correct.
Boom.
So in terms of
white people, am I right?
Yes. There is a lot of them. In terms of the number of people who participate, I don't have that answer, but I can tell you in 2014 the World Dipcon had 87 players total.
Okay, so I think,
so again,
I remember,
this is a top level play, but top level tournament. But I don't know if there's regional competitions to get there or not. But
gotcha.
Yeah, the top level tournament is 87 people. Can you guess the amount of women?
4.
2.
Fuck. God.
Two women, 2 players under 21, and 4 non-white people.
How far did the women make it?
You know, I'm not sure, but there are some. There's a woman who was interviewed in one of these articles. She is a daughter of a hardcore board gamer father mm-hmm. who would drag her to his board gaming conventions her entire kind of childhood. So she has a pretty good understanding of board game nerds. And
yeah, I guess the reason I ask is I feel like when the dynamic and the demographics are that imbalanced, I feel like no matter what your skill is, it might be hard as a woman to convince like a group of men that large. I just feel sometimes, one, women aren't heard as often just in general, right? Or just their say doesn't go as far in general, generally speaking, hashtag sexism. But I do think just like with that general imbalance, like if you're one woman, how many people play at a time?
A game can have up to 7 people. And so tournament play would have seven people. Like you'd be playing 6 guys, 1 girl. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think the odds, intentionally or not, like are going to be against you. And I think it's also natural to gravitate towards people who look like you. And so even if it's not, you know, intentional or malicious, I can see it being a bigger barrier for women to overcome to win that. Similar, I would imagine, with people of color, if it's just like a sea of white people.
Yeah, what you are describing
is systemic racism and sexism.
Yeah, but the kind of the built-in exclusionary aspect of a lot of nerd culture, whether it's board games or video games or comic conventions, like it's notorious. It's young white men, right? Yeah. And often not just young white men, but young white men of privilege
who don't necessarily recognize that they have privilege, or they do. And
right.
Yeah.
Right. But so even the ones that do, you know, by themselves, they're not able to change the wider culture. So yes, it is a definite problem. I believe, I can't find the quote now, but I believe World DipCon has tried to, expand kind of who helps to run the tournament to at least build representation at kind of the leadership level, right? In order to attract more players, right? And have a better understanding of how to bring a wider player base. But
I'll play. I bet I'd be good.
I bet you would. But again, like these are long games. Like they start at 5 p.m. You might not be done until 3-4 in the morning, right?
Oh,
like,
that's perfect. That's exactly true. My schedule.
You are a night owl.
I thought you were gonna say 5 a.m. and I was like, oof.
No, you can't get up that early. But so yeah, I mean, so like for example, that woman I was mentioning earlier, like she started playing Diplomacy when she was 13 years old because she basically was following her dad around a convention, and there was an open spot at a Diplomacy table, and some nice guys apparently were like, hey, do you want to play? And kind of dragged her into the game. She ended up winning that first game.
Which I bet was a huge morale boost. Like, think about that. That's got to be the launching pad of her whole trajectory, on top of her dad playing, but beating a bunch of grown-ass men when you're a 13-year-old girl.
And it's specifically because she convinced the older people to help her out and then would ruthlessly backstab them.
That's fucking amazing. Right? I do feel sometimes, like, as a woman, you can, I will say that is an
exploitive
advantage.
In some way.
You can kind of exploit it because you're like, oh, I don't know what I'm, I mean, I'm completely generalizing here, but I think if you can read your audience well, if you know they're going to sympathize with that, or if they have something you can kind of poke at and you can find that soft spot, like if it's a bunch of dads or whatever, yeah you're like, oh, you remind me of my daughter. And it's like this innocent thing. You're like, fuck, we just lost to a 13-year-old. Right.
And again, this wouldn't have been this would not have been a tournament level play. This would have been just like a regular board game convention, but still amazing. Yeah.
I never let kids win when I play games with them. I'm like, fuck that.
Yeah. Teach them how to lose before you teach them how to win.
Exactly.
She has a quote too about the type of people the game attracts. And again, I think this would appeal to you. She says, this is kind of alpha nerds. It attracts very intelligent people. It attracts extroverted people. If you're introverted and won't put yourself out there, it won't work out for you. It attracts people who like to talk. If you don't like to talk, this game's over pretty quickly for you.
Are you saying I'm a chatty genius? Because I agree.
I'm saying you can move in that world. How's that?
Can you, I just want you to say live on air, Brenna, you're a genius. Let's say it together now. 3, 2, 1. Brenna, you're a genius.
As you might imagine, so as you might imagine, though, like we're talking a lot about the people who do enjoy it, right? It's not exclusively well loved. One person who is known to be a care bear, in that he always plays as much as possible to have a strong alliance, not break the alliance, play to get a draw, right? He likes to encourage a game that's cooperative and coordinates with other people. He describes himself as not really liking diplomacy, even though he continues to go to play these, right? So there, you know, there's a spectrum of people who play it, but in terms of like player retention, there's a lot of people who will try it, but not come back, right?
I can see that. Yeah, it is it's lengthy, and I think it is probably mentally taxing. And if you're not someone, because I noticed this with Secret Hitler, like you have a lot of people who get really into it, and you have people who like really don't like it because of the deception and the argumentation and like the fact that they have to lie. So like I know people who hate it for that reason. So I can say, yeah, just not being everyone's cup of tea.
But yeah, so there is a lot of people who don't enjoy playing the game, at least not after the first time, right? And so for a lot of them, it's ultimately about the aggressive nature of the game, right? The tension that it creates while you're playing. And to quote one of the top tournament players, he says, "You have to have thick skin to play this game. Bad things are going to happen. And, you know, every 10 people who like playing games, 9 will not like playing diplomacy." Right. But again, in terms of like people will try it, right? So you'll get people who want to try it because it's a very social game, right? Mm-hmm. But then they have this kind of tactical thing where you're studying a map and you're trying to like, it's like watching a movie where like people, there's like a giant map of, you know, Europe, and people are like pointing, like, we're going to attack here and here. It's literally, that's the game.
Yeah. It's, right? It's legit strategy execution, right? And then tactical convincing of your opponent slash ally. Well, to draw another parallel to Survivor again, the reason I think of it here too is, you know, people want to give it a try, and then they realize how much they hate it or whatever. They can only do it once. Like I was talking earlier about how people can get so bitter and so surprised if they're blindsided, voted out, backstabbed. And I always think to myself, like, what? Like, this show has been on for fucking 20 years. Like, what are you expecting? And people really take it personally. Yeah. And not everyone, but a lot of people. And they take it harder than they think. And you have a really bitter group of people at the end who they might have lied and backstabbed someone, but fuck if you do it to them. Like, it really hurts and they cannot let go of it. And I've read that people actually have to go into a lot of therapy after Survivor.
Wow.
Because they really, trust they'll issues. Go home and they don't know if their wife is lying to them. Like, I remember one winner, who I really like, he said, yeah, he had to be in therapy for a couple months because he just didn't know if everyone was lying to him at work, because you are ingrained. This is obviously such a unique and intense case where you're sequestered on an island for 40 days with no outside world connection and people are lying to you and you're constantly reassessing if they are. But yeah, I mean, I guess it does have deeper impacts on the psyche than I'm sure even I realize, and I could be thrown into it, and I'm sure it would be devastating in that kind of setting to be backstabbed when you think you really are bonding with someone.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. Like, again, I completely agree. Like, it seems like, how do you not recognize it's a game? But when you're so into it, like when you're so that deep in, right? Like in Survivor, you're literally what, on a remote island.
Yeah.
Not talking to anyone else except the people playing. In this, not quite that level of isolation, but you're playing a game that's lasting 8, 9, 10 hours into the middle of the night.
Yeah.
You're talking to these people over and over and over, never knowing how to trust. Like that's got to get to you. But I think what's interesting to me too is that a lot of what you'll read from these players is that it's not just the people who are backstabbed that have to deal with kind of the emotional fallout of that moment. It's the backstabbing themselves. So there's a guy named Thomas Haver, who is a self-described Care Bear. He, again, tries to be honest, tries to be truthful, tries to play to draws. And in one specific tournament, it worked to his advantage because he knew no one would think he would ever backstab. And finally, he saw a specific opportunity to do so, and it would win him the game by himself, right?
Yeah.
And he took it. And the other player kind of saw that it was a possibility, but again,
just didn't think they would do it.
Knew the reputation of Thomas Haver and that he wouldn't do it. And so years of basically playing as a trustworthy ally was thrown away, but it got him the victory. And he says the guilt from doing that, though, for him lasted for days. And it would just like keep him up at night thinking about how challenging that was.
Oh, I'm sure. I believe it. Yeah. I mean, again, another parallel survivor, like really big fan, read a lot of interviews with people who've played. But yeah, similar story where just, you know, they backstabbed someone and they just felt it was so incongruent with their character, or they really felt that their bond with this person went beyond the game, but they knew they had to do it in order to win, and they wouldn't win if they took the person with them. And yeah, it just, you see people really break down, and sometimes that impact lasts beyond the days of the game, and people won't talk to each other after it's over. And yeah, right. it can really take a toll on someone emotionally.
Right. And it's like, I mean, with Survivor too, right? The payoff is significantly bigger. I don't know what the diplomacy
$1 million.
I don't know what the DipCon like payout is for a winner, but it's not $1 million. But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. It to know that you were close and your like choice of like alliance, your honest choice of trust, right, is the reason that you didn't get that. That's gotta be really hard on you.
Yeah.
Kind of the last thing I have on this, but there, we talked a lot in the puzzles episode too about why I don't like puzzles. Mm-hmm. And this also, when I was thinking about this episode and why kind of I want to do it, is it kind of brought to light to me one of the reasons why I don't like puzzles, but why I like this kind of thing. And that's because with puzzles, like, I compare puzzles to board games so much in my mind, but like with puzzles and a lot of types of games where you are cooperating to achieve a common thing, like against the board, against a computer, artificial intelligence, whatever it is, right? It doesn't feel significant, I guess, to me to have actually won that, to actually complete that, right? So like putting a puzzle together, I'm like, great, I've figured out the steps to get something in. Mm-hmm. But to play a game like this, or Secret Hitler, or any like situation where you have to kind of outwit someone else who is constantly working against you,
yep,
right?
Yeah.
Or working with you, but then you happen to figure out when they're gonna try to work against you, right? Like, you
backstab them first,
right? Like, that really appeals to me. And so I think that's why, like, I always enjoyed playing diplomacy, even though I could only get friends to do it a couple times in high school and then never ever again, right? Or was forced to do it in class. I played a couple games online, you know, but that's not quite the same thing as being in the room with people, I think. Yeah. Although you're less likely to get punched in the face, which is probably a good thing.
Did you see someone get punched in the face?
No, but I just mean, like, sometimes people's anger really gets them, right? So but the point I'm trying to make here is that, like, having that kind of human element where you're really working against someone or working with someone, but also working against, like, I really enjoy that.
There's no one right way of doing things. You have to be able to play to the situation and the people in any given game.
Yeah, exactly. Because with like with puzzles, or I mean, even games like Pandemic, if anyone's played that, or other games like that, where it's, you're kind of working together and this ideally is like an optimal solution. Like it's, in some way, all you're doing is optimizing, right? It's like an algorithm that you're trying to find the quickest solution to. And I understand that for some people that's enjoyable. I'm not trying to say that's not. But for me, I think what I find enjoyment is not that, but it's being competitive against other people without actually caring if I lose, right?
Yeah,
without
yeah.
having that like level of I care about the competition. And that's Dip Connors. If you've ever been backstabbed horribly in a game, or backstabbed someone horribly in a game and want to tell us your amazing story, send it to us. We probably don't care, but we'll read it. You can send it to us on Instagram at Subsecurity Podcast. Our Twitter handle is at Subsecurity Pod, and our website is subsecurity.com. You can also email us directly. We're at subsecurity@gmail.com. Our intro and outro music is the instrumental of We're Better Together by Gil Mordecai. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week.